Welcome to the Texas Crime Cast by the Dallas Morning News. I'm Jen Emily. This week we talk about the suspicious death of a Dallas lawyer beloved by the legal community and the fallout after the rape scandal at Baylor. Joining me in the studio today are police reporter Tasha Taparis, investigative reporter Sue Ambrose, and breaking news reporter Naheed Rajwani. Editorial writer Mike Hashimoto ends the show in our usual way with his latest Hashing It Out. He talks about why we feel differently about a teen who killed at 13 and was granted parole after going to juvenile lockup compared to affluenza teen Ethan Couch. Attorney Ira Tobolowsky died last month, Friday the 13th, when his colorful 68-year-old life ended prematurely on the floor of his garage at his North Dallas home. This much is known. There was a fire, and firefighters found his dead body. Most other details remain shrouded in mystery weeks later. Before we delve into the mystery of Ira's death, Tasha, can you tell us a little bit about the man? It seems that everywhere we go, we run into people who knew him and can't say enough about what a great man and what a great lawyer he was. What made him so beloved?
Well, first of all, it seems he was just an exceptional attorney. He worked in the civil court system. He was not a criminal lawyer at all, but he was very well known for being a family man. He really loved his family. Everyone that I talked to mentioned that he always put his family first. He wanted to leave on time. He even started his own law practice so that he would have the flexibility of being able to go to his son's baseball games or basketball games or soccer games. He made an effort to be at family events. He even made an effort with his friends and their children, being a part of their lives and going to even his friends' kids' sporting outings or whatever they were involved in. So he just was really considered a loving and loyal person. Also, he was known to be a bit of a prankster. He had quite a sense of humor. He played a lot of pranks on people that at first, you know, seemed kind of mean, but it was like the slow burn joke where after a little bit you realize, oh, wait, that's hilarious. And I understand that at his funeral there were a lot of the jokes and pranks that he had pulled on people shared.
Can you tell us about one of those pranks that he pulled?
Well, he was known for putting his sister's bras in the freezer before their date nights so that they wouldn't be ready. He also, one time, his sister had a speeding ticket and he went to court with her to try to get it dismissed. And before she showed up, he told the judge, "Hey, judge, whatever I do, even if it seems a little crazy, just please go along with it." So she shows up and he says, "Judge, I'm really disappointed in my sister for getting this speeding ticket, and I would like you to annul our relationship." And the judge pounds his gavel and says, "Granted." And his sister just bursts into tears, thinking that she's no longer related to her brother and just doesn't understand what's happening. And it's one of those things in the moment. It's like, oh, no, that's so mean. But later, you know, it's like one of his friends described it as he was able to pull the kind of pranks that seemed kind of a big deal at the time, but it just proved the point that whatever it was that that person was worrying about wasn't that important, that it was just a minor part of life, because he was known to not really be a worrier. He was just kind of a go with it and focused on the big and more important things in his life.
And he's also known for, as a young lawyer, he tried a case successfully before the Supreme Court, and the opposing counsel was someone that we've all heard of.
Yes, future Justice Alito. He went before Supreme Court. There's actually, you can hear the audio recording of that and hear him argue the case. And he was alone against a stacked, you know, government counsel. And he did that, you know, about a decade after graduating from law school. So he was a successful attorney. And he was known typically to win. And there were stories about how even times that he would try a case, opposing counsel would end up really just liking him, and he even got hired by some of those people later on.
The one quote that I found fascinating in your story about him was that he was a lawyer's lawyer. I felt like that really captured maybe the personality that he had.
He was the person that people went to for advice. I mean, regular people would go to him just for advice about life, because he had as I was told, a strong moral compass. But he was also just really good attorney. So other attorneys would go to him. Sometimes other attorneys would hire him to do work.
And in his, you know, life away from the court, he actually met his wife, on a night that he'd turned down a pretty big date that few people would pass up on. Is that right?
Yes. Well, she was a neighborhood girl, and he turned down Miss Universe. He'd won a date and instead sent his brother on that date and went out basically for the first time with the woman he ended up marrying. And they were married for quite a while.
And together they had three sons?
They did. They did. And actually, we can take a moment to hear from them now.
If there's one thing that I'd want everyone to remember about my dad is that he was 100% my hero, and there was no question about that. Dad had a much more unique relationship with each of us than I think is typical of a father and a son. We all looked at him not just as a dad and as a mentor, but as our best friend as well. I think I speak for all of us when we say we each spoke to him every single day.
So Tasha, what happened on the day of his death? I know there's not a lot that's known, but what do we know so far?
Well, the official word is that it was a suspicious fire. The fire started in the garage. His wife was in the home, and from what I understand, had actually called 911 after seeing the smoke. It was around the time that Ira would have been going to work. And, you know, firefighters arrived. It took several hours for them to actually put out the fire. It damaged a large portion of that end of the house, the garage, some area above, and a little bit beyond. And in that time, you know, they realized Ira wasn't there, and his body was found in the garage. There were reports that there was some kind of accelerant in the garage. And the family and friends have said that because of a spinal condition, Ira wasn't really able to do his own lawn or any of his yard work. So he wasn't known to keep gasoline in that garage. So the fire department basically called it a suspicious fire. They have not said whether it was arson, explicitly said whether it was intentionally set, but just called the fire itself suspicious. It took about a week before the case was turned over to the Dallas Police Department, and homicide detectives are investigating, although it has not been explicitly called a quote-unquote murder because the medical examiner is still has not ruled on the cause of his death. So they're pending tests on that. And basically that can mean that they are testing to see whether there was accelerant on his body.
How is the family doing? The son, I believe one of the sons was planning on getting married soon?
Yes, just got married this past weekend. Their attitude about that was that their father, or his father rather, I guess, would have wanted him to continue his life. I know that was something that the family was really, really excited for. Apparently he was looking forward to having grandchildren. But not a lot of the family has really spoken out about the cause of his death. The kind of behind the scenes talk is that they've been told not to speak too much publicly about it because it is under investigation and there's still a lot of unanswered questions.
There's a lot of suspicion that one of Ira's legal cases could be behind what happened if it turns out that it is arson, that it is murder. And there has been a lot about that out in public because it came up in a court hearing after his death. Can you tell us a little bit about that case and why the public and those who knew Ira have kind of honed in on that case as, you know, a possible link?
Sure. So he actually filed a lawsuit against two men who used to be Austin residents, but now evidently live in Dallas. The lawsuit was basically a defamation case. He said that they were smearing his name in public and private places, made comments about the quality of him as an attorney, made personal comments about his religious beliefs and whether he was actually a religious man. He was known to be a practicing Jew. So they brought up Judaism in many of the filings. The Ira had been hired by one of the men's mother during a family dispute regarding the family trust. And during that time, it was rather contentious. There were several lawsuits filed in that debate, I guess, or fight over the family money. And many of those filings just became more and more, I want to be careful in how just harsh words.
It was a nasty case.
It was a nasty case. There were accusations about whether he was using, whether Iro was using the woman to get her money and not really representing her fairly as an attorney. And so there were a lot of nasty words said in public legal documents, hence the defamation case. And so that case in particular has come up quite a bit. Also, the judge presiding over that case said in court that one of the defendants in the case had implications in Mr. Tobolowsky's death, and he recused himself. The judge recused himself from that case. Basically, he removed himself from overseeing the case because of safety concerns because of Ira's death.
And those accusations in the defamation case are contrary to everything else that anyone has ever said about Ira Tobolowsky.
Correct. From what I could tell, I read a lot of his cases and went through a lot of the filings and talked to a lot of people and heard from people even after the story ran about his life. And it seems that the people or person who had the most negative to say about him was the one involved in that defamation case. But again, there's nothing publicly to say that they are connected. It may not be connected at all. The police have not named anyone as a suspect. The men involved in that defamation case haven't been said whether they're people of interest or if one of them is a person of interest. So there's just a lot of questions. But it is the one case that came up in pretty much every conversation that I and some colleagues had with people regarding Ira Tobolowsky's death. That was the name and names that came up repeatedly. So, it is worth a look.
Do we know if the detective assigned to the case has talked to those men or one of those men? Have they been to their apartment, anything like that?
We do believe that they have been to their apartment. They were seen. Police officers were seen at the men's apartment. I guess that was about 2 weeks ago now. I know that the homicide detective on the case was actually at a court hearing on the defamation case, and it seems that he was there to see whether either of those men appeared. But police have not publicly said whether they have interviewed either of the men.
So really, as far as the public is concerned, the next thing that we'll know or that could lead to finding out more about the case is what the medical examiner says, whether it was an accident, whether it was murder, that kind of thing.
Correct. Once the medical examiner officially rules on cause of death, says it is officially a homicide, at that point, I think we'll have a better sense of where this might go.
And sometimes that could take a lot of weeks. So I guess we'll just have to wait and see what the timeline looks like in terms of that.
Those toxicology results, just to even test whether there was a substance on his skin, I mean, that could take up to 8 weeks to return or more.
Now we turn our attention to Baylor University in Waco, home of the largest Baptist college in the nation. The follow-up continues from the rape scandal involving the football team and how the school handled complaints of sexual assault against its players. The school fired football coach Art Briles and demoted president Ken Starr. Now Ken Starr has resigned as chancellor. Sue, walk us through how this all came to light. What were the accusations? And some aren't just accusations. Two players were convicted of sexual assault.
Yes, this situation really became prominent in the media in the fall of 2015, but the actual problems with sexual assault by football players at Baylor dates back much further. So in January of 2014, a football player named Tevin Elliott was convicted by a Waco jury of sexual assault of a student. That assault had occurred in April of 2012. He was convicted. He was sentenced to 20 years in prison, and that's where he is right now. In late August of 2015, another football player named Sam Ukuwachu was convicted of sexual assault, again in Waco, again of sexually assaulting a fellow student. And at the trial, it came out that Baylor had done its own internal investigation, as they are required to under federal law, and had cleared Ukuwachu. So we had a situation where Baylor had cleared a student, but then a jury had found that student guilty. So there was some sort of disconnect there of why those two findings didn't match up. At that point, the university regents hired a law firm from Philadelphia to investigate how the school has responded to sexual assaults on campus. And that law firm has been working, you know, since that point. In the meantime, there have been a lot of media reports of other problems with the football team. And where we are right now is that the investigation appears to be largely complete, although we don't know that. And the regents are beginning to take actions against people at the school.
And there's been a lot of scrutiny about how Briles and Starr and the school handled these sexual assault accusations, because there are more accusations beyond the two players who were convicted. What did the school and Starr do, and what did they not do? Do we know at this point?
We know some things, but one of the issues right now is there's a lot that we don't know. We do know, for example, that in 2011, the federal government urged all universities who accept federal money, and that includes Baylor, to designate a single employee as a Title IX coordinator. What that means is a person in charge of enforcing the federal law, Title IX, that requires schools to investigate allegations of sexual assault and give accommodation to students who claim they've been sexually assaulted. Baylor didn't do that until 2014. They had someone handling Title IX investigations, but this person was not dedicated to that, and had appears to have had a lot of other responsibilities as well. As far as Starr himself, again, we don't know much. Starr is just starting to give interviews now, and Briles has been accused in a lawsuit of not taking enough action against football players. But he is just starting to speak publicly, and again, there's actually, I think, more we don't know than we do.
What are your top questions? If you could, you know, sit down with Starr or Briles or the Board of Regents or the law firm who did the investigation, what are the top things you would want to know?
I would like to know details. Last week, the Board of Regents issued a summary of this law firm's findings. It was very damning. It faulted, you know, the university at high levels of administration. It faulted the athletic program for instituting its own separate system of discipline for the football team. But at the same, so while this report was very damning, it also didn't have a lot of details. It didn't have dates. It didn't have descriptions of what actually happened to various students who were accused or students who said they were assaulted. And it used generic terms like school officials, athletic officials, but not specific titles of employees. So it's still hard to really understand what has gone on and where the school and various people have fallen short.
So essentially, it sounds like you want to know from specific people, what did you know, when did you know it, and what did you do about it, or what did you not do about it, and why didn't you do it?
That's correct.
I heard some interviews with Ken Starr where he was actually kind of calling out the Board of Regents, saying that they should release more of that, and that he didn't know as much about kind of the, I guess, punishment or how those cases were investigated. So, I mean, why can a university have their own internal investigation that is so contradictory to a criminal court?
Well, under Title IX, which is a federal statute, that statute makes sex discrimination in educational settings against the law, and sexual assault is a violation of this is a civil rights law, and sexual assault is the most extreme form of sex discrimination, and therefore universities are required to investigate it. There's a lot of discussion about whether they're properly equipped to investigate it, you know, at schools across the nation, but they are obliged, and they don't have to achieve the same level of proof, for example, that a criminal jury would. They, in a criminal case, to prove someone is guilty of sexual assault, the prosecutors have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt to the jury that, you know, this the perpetrator is guilty. in Title IX investigations, the standard is much lower. You know, if there's a preponderance of evidence, meaning a shade over 50%, that that there was an assault, then that's enough for the school to take action.
But it did the exact opposite of that. You know, I mean,
that's right.
If it is, I mean, he was proven guilty beyond a reasonable doubt, and then yet the school didn't.
I think there's a lot of questions about, you know, how well did Baylor or in other universities investigate these claims? How much did they want to know? And how many people were assigned to the investigation? Do you have one person doing it? And is that person independent, or are they beholden to the football coach? Are they beholden to the football team? And, you know, they need someone who's truly independent to be doing this.
Yeah, and we don't know. I mean, we don't know if they were beholden to anyone. We don't really understand what happened. So, you know, I don't want to it's, again, with the level of information we have now, those questions are not easily answered.
I know schools a lot of times will use, you know, student privacy laws as a way to say, oh, I'm sorry, we can't release information as much as we want to about this case. Has Baylor said anything about, in general, who, you know, what are the people that sit on these groups that investigate allegations of sexual assault? Have they said, in general, this is the process that we follow?
They have revamped their process recently, and it's the previous process is a little unclear to me, but they also have said that in some cases they're restricted from explaining things to the press because of student privacy. However, if you look at investigations that the Office for Civil Rights has done from the Department of Education, the Federal Department of Education, when they do investigations, they get pretty detailed, and they still protect student privacy. That's not what we saw when the Baylor Regents released their summary of this investigation that's been going on since September.
Right, and it's pretty common. I mean, we as journalists request records all the time, and we're used to redactions. You know, information that could potentially violate someone's, you know, right to privacy. We accept that it's redacted, but.
Especially
sometimes.
The names of victims. Like, I think most of us would expect that the victims
The names of victims, social security numbers, driver's license numbers, addresses of a victim, and that kind of thing. Sue, what's still to come? Do you anticipate any further action from the Board of Regents, or maybe are you hoping for more action from the Board of Regents?
You know, I think there probably will be more actions. I don't really, there's been no indication of what and when. Pepper Hamilton, the law firm that has been doing this investigation at the Regents' behest since the fall, as far as we know, still has not provided a detailed written report of their findings. What we have so far is, you know, the Regents' own summary of their findings. So that's one thing that might come in the future. And then, you know, we'll have to wait and see if any more news comes out about employees who have been terminated.
You've mentioned federal civil rights investigations. Is there a possibility here that there could be a federal investigation of what happened at Baylor?
Yes, that is a possibility. ESPN reported yesterday that they confirmed one person has filed a complaint with the Office for Civil Rights. We don't know whether that complaint will translate into an investigation, but it's certainly possible, and the Office for Civil Rights can also initiate investigations on its own. As of yesterday, when that office released their latest list of what schools they are investigating for sexual violence issues under Title IX, Baylor was not on it.
And right now, the coach Briles is gone, but the football team is still continuing. Although several players who have committed are saying they now want to go elsewhere, a couple are still saying they want to go to Baylor. The NCAA has to weigh in all of this, which may be something that's of interest to sports fans. I mean, there could be sanctions like losing scholarships. They could end the football program at Baylor. They could institute what's known as the death penalty. Do you have any indication of you know, what's going on with that, or is that just something that will happen when it happens?
I don't have any indication so far on that. I know Baylor has said that it hired a law firm to help Baylor self-report problems to the NCAA, and so we might be seeing some more details on that in coming weeks or months.
There's a lot of talk about how we as a country got to know Starr because he was the special prosecutor who investigated President Bill Clinton. And that investigation included Clinton's sex life and Monica Lewinsky and the most famous blue dress in the country, if not the world. How does what happened at Baylor impact Starr's legacy?
As far as Starr's legacy, I think we have to wait and see. He has accepted responsibility, but he has also said that he has not been, as he put it, he has been behind a veil of ignorance. And I think that's how he put it. He says there's a lot he's not privy to. So, you know, I don't really know. I think it's a little premature to say how this impacts his legacy. Certainly he will be tied to it, but I don't really, I think it's still a little early to say how things are going to end up.
So from now on, when people mention Ken Starr, they're going to mention Bill Clinton and Monica Lewinsky, and they're also going to mention Baylor and rape and the football team.
I think that's true. We'll have to see exactly how things play out in the future, though. There's still, like I said, there's still a lot we just don't know.
That's all for us today. Thanks for listening. You'll hear the latest Hashing It Out in just a moment. Read more about the stories we talked about today on DallasNews.com, and remember to like our page on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. We are at Texas Crime Cast. Thanks to our sound engineer, Tommy Noel. For Tasha DeParis, Sue Ambrose, and Naheed Rajwani, I'm Jen Emily. We hope you stay safe out there. Now we drop the mic.
If you know one juvenile justice case, I'm betting it's Ethan Couch, and for one word, affluenza. That was what a psychologist invented to describe rich parents who gave him every material thing but no human values. So who could blame a 16-year-old for stealing beer, driving extremely drunk, and crashing into people trying to help a stranded driver in southern Tarrant County? But what made reasonable people truly crazed about Ethan's story was when a judge decided juvenile custody just wouldn't suit him. No, what he needed was probation and rehab. Juvie jail? That was for poor kids. Reaction was swift and continues 3 years on. So where's the outrage for a different teen who, as a 13-year-old, killed his girlfriend, stepfather, and mother in Garland and was set free because he was now an adult? Capital murder outranks intoxication manslaughter, right? Forget affluenza. Your word today is accountability. What made heads explode over the Couch sentence, and thank you, Judge Gene Boyd, was that he served zero jail time, not a day. Well, until he surprised almost no one by busting his probation and skipping off to Mexico with his mother. The Garland teen served 5 years. You may judge that's not enough for his crimes, and the dead man's family certainly does. But that's 5 years longer than Ethan Couch served for killing 4 people. The Garland teen, by all accounts, turned himself around in custody. He proves that some kids rate a second chance if they earn it. Not if it's an unearned gift from a soft-headed judge.